This episode of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 27th of May 2012 on Monocle 24. On the Monocle Weekly, episode 151, we'll be sitting down with pop music aristocracy as we're joined by the mighty Scissor Sisters to talk about their lives, loves, and their names being mispronounced hilariously on Asian tours.
And we'll be talking to Guy Delisle, the man behind some of the most sophisticated and arresting graphic novels released.
Plus, there's more than one way to have fun in Las Vegas. This one involves guns and ammo.
That's all right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Sounds like a good show.
It does, doesn't it?
I can't wait.
Scissor Sisters.
I know. I know. I like it when a band of their ilk and size come into the Intimidori house. There is a sort of palpable air of expectation.
And I know.
There's lots of people kind of hanging around the reception desk chatting when they normally would be at their desk.
You should sit up in the
or down the pub.
Floor. Everyone's a flutter.
Yeah, exactly.
Lots of people suddenly needing to run down and make coffees very urgently.
Yeah. Oh, I wouldn't normally come in on a Sunday.
We've got to force some instruments into their hands and make them play.
I know.
I know
exactly.
They've said next time, but.
I know. I think they will. It was just us two, us merry two, Jonathan.
It is.
It's been a while since I've seen you across the studio desk.
Yeah. Well, I've been kind of out on the road vaguely. I was off in Rome earlier this week, which was actually the worst weather Rome's had in about 3 years, apparently.
I bet they thanked you for bringing them that.
Torrential thunderstorms. Well, I didn't even, because this is the first time in London that we've had any kind of sun this week. So it was good to be looking on Facebook, getting texts from friends being like, God, it's so nice. We're going to like hit the roofs in Soho or whatever. And I was under an umbrella. In Rome.
People in Riyadh saying, God, I'm jealous of the weather.
Yeah.
I know. Nice. It's just about time. It's nice to be kind of stripped off in here.
I know. Perfect for this for this sunny weekend.
I thought you were gonna segue into the Scissor Sisters again there.
Can't stay away from them.
I know. How's the week been? It's been pretty nuts, closing an issue, etc.
It is very busy and going into the final few days of production as of tomorrow. And then off to Marrakesh on Wednesday.
Oh, nice one.
Yeah, it's the FT Luxury Conference kicking off, so a few of us will be heading over there and doing lots of reports and luxury things.
Luxury things? Is that lace-up shoes? Is that suit but no socks and lace-up shoes?
Sounds quite luxurious.
Do you get away with that? Can you get
Sounds
away with
quite
that?
Luxurious. We're going to be covering the whole luxury spectrum.
Luxury
and,
spectrum.
And
I know so I'm not going.
Got some quality interviews lined up, so it should be fun.
Nice. Well, I think without further ado, we're going to rock on and head out to the Scissor Sisters. Now, it won't take you many hours of listening to Monocle 24 to realise that we're all a little bit obsessed with a well-crafted pop song in all its incarnations, and it seems we're not alone. Our first guests this week are three souls forever in search of the perfect pop track. This journey has taken them from the underground clubs of New York City to the very biggest stages in the world, including the Olympics, I think. Welcome, Jake Shears, Baby Daddy and Del Marquee.
Hello.
Three-fifths of Scissor Sisters.
Mm.
Hi.
Well, three-fourths.
Three-fourths.
Three-quarters.
Yeah.
So it's Scissor Sis. We can go for that
far
down
much
the name.
Scissor-sis.
Well, it depends on who you count as what. I guess there's eight people on stage.
There's eight of us
on stage. So
you might
even be three-eighths.
So, yeah, it depends how you're counting. But in the photos, it's four.
Okay.
And we are playing.
That's where they say
that's
where the important thing. Right?
And we are playing the Olympics, yes. Or around the Olympics, yeah.
In fact, we almost started off with a maths exam there. I was kind of wondering at what point interviewing you guys we'd start talking about fractions, but we started off straight away.
We understand fractions.
Only,
I know you do.
I would be more apt to talk
I never
about
could.
Fractions.
I flopped in high school.
God, thank God.
If that gives you any indication, I was still doing fractions in high school.
Imagine if someone put long division in front of you right now.
Goodness gracious me. Magic hour. Mm. This is what we could call this moment that we're sharing now. Some sort of magic hour.
It feels magical.
Hopefully it's not going to last that long.
Come on, it's going to be fine.
Magical. No.
The magic hour, what is a magic hour? Where's that come from?
Jake, you want to talk about it?
It's the hour before, I guess they use it in
is it?
You know, movie lingo. It's the hour, photography, it's the hour right after sunset, right as the sun's setting, and the hour right before sunrise.
This is okay.
In this case, it's the hour before sunrise.
It's the kind of blue thing. I think the French call it something like that. They call it
the l'heure
bleue. And
exactly.
It's this idea of this.
You know what we
thing.
Found out yesterday? We were in Paris and they called it entre chien et loup, which is between
dog and wolf.
Dog and wolf.
Oh, wow.
I don't know what that really
Damn
means,
them
it's
for being
cool,
so poetic.
Right? Yeah, it's kind of
sexy,
amazing.
Though.
All right, we'll
it's also called
hour.
The golden hour. It's that moment when the light is perfect.
Okay.
No shadows.
Yeah. And you were sort of announced this. I think you announced this on Twitter that this record was coming out, and you were finishing it at the end of last year, and now you're in London to talk about it. Where were the influences? What were the influences? Are you still out and about? Is it still clubland that the influences are from, as well as ballads? Where do you go to do your research for new records?
I've been running all over the world the last year and a half. I've started DJing and. Yeah. I was with a buddy of mine for quite a while, and we sort of taught ourselves how to do it, and really just like fell in love with it, and have been on top of making the record, and you know, the band is still touring some this fall, yeah. And everything. You're listening to a ton of dance music.
And what does DJing teach you that kind of just playing or riffing or being in the studio doesn't? Is it being able to put everything in the right order?
Kind of, yeah, going. And just yeah. Hearing, just always digging for new stuff, and so that, I mean, that's definitely part of it, and part of it was just sort of having a good time writing songs and not really worrying necessarily about influences or style. I mean, we would go the record stylistically is really all over the place.
Uh-huh. It's kind of funny actually, because you know, the clubbing thing, and I'm sure Jake being in the clubs really influenced things, but I think it was also sort of the polar opposite to or at least an answer maybe to Night Work, which was the you know, a club album.
Definitely.
We wanted it to
yeah.
feel like a night out dancing, and there weren't really rules about it, but there was definitely the idea, oh, let's not really put a piano ballad on there. It's not really going to fit in that vibe. And this time around, it's like, okay, there are kind of no guidelines. Again, let's just do anything we want to do.
It was sort of a free-for-all. And also the fact that we enlisted Alex Rita, who's also known as uh-huh. Boys Noise,
yeah.
To do a lot of the production with us and, you know, wrote quite a bit of the stuff with us. You know, he comes from a really heavy techno background, and so
yeah,
really...
once again, really, you know, a guy that knows dance like anyone else, uh-huh. but is so much broader than his love, you know, the stuff that he loves musically, and his talent goes way beyond that club thing.
And if you don't have a kind of set down template like Night Work was going to be a dance record, if you don't have a template, does that kind of set you free when you can? Someone walks into the studio with this riff, that riff, or they want to do something featuring this instrument, or they want to do a collaboration. There's a collaboration with Azalea Banks on the record as well. That's a good song.
Thanks.
Yeah. Shady Love.
Yeah.
But that's a very dancey thing. It's kind of got. But there sounds like there's different influences going on in there.
Yeah, there was just no real guidelines, I would say. I mean, the Baby Daddy and I are, it's like we're very much a push and pull. It's like, uh-huh. you know, we both like trying new things, but I'll, you know, like, if I had my druthers, we'd be making like a techno record with no vocals.
And, exactly. And
he
mine
brings me back
have,
in.
Wouldn't have a beat on it.
That should be your answer too when people ask, so what is the future for Sister Sisters? No vocals,
yeah, right.
Techno record.
Like, don't tell the record company, but we've done this.
Exactly. Right.
And what about playing live? I mean, is it still the proving ground for your stuff to be able to play it live? Do you enjoy being in the studio more?
I mean, it is a proving ground. I mean, it's really important that all the stuff translates, and you really have to think about that when you're in the studio, and you have to consider that when you're writing songs and what you're going to put on the album, and sometimes you never know really how it's going to turn out
before you get on stage.
The
only thing we don't do is test these before they go on an album and decide from there what's gonna end up on the album. I think we realize what's going to work when we're putting the album together, and we know a few of them actually will sound great on record and aren't necessarily going to work as well live, and that's fine.
But then Shady Love, for instance, was one of like a real surprise from even the last couple weeks, because we just started playing this stuff for the first time live in front of audiences, and that was one of those that we were just like, is this gonna, like, who knows if this is gonna work? We could be able to pull this off. Well, let's try it. And like,
it's
actually
one of the strongest in the
set. It's massive. Yeah. It's a big epic number in the show.
When it comes down to it, it's a rhythm song. It's a drum song, and it's just
it's a pulsing thing.
Yeah,
it goes along. It's kind of like a, I don't know if it's like a bulldozer or a roller coaster ride. Maybe we should hear it. Or
maybe it's like a roller dozer.
A roller dozer.
A bull coaster.
Bull coaster.
That doesn't sound as good.
That sounds kind of fun. I'd get on a bull coaster.
I bet you would.
Do you want to pick a track from the new record? We're gonna play one in right now.
Since we're talking about Shady Love, should we do Shady Love?
Let's have Shady Love.
Yeah.
All right.
Give me a bump and I hop out the whip. Girl, what you drinking, boy, give me a sip. I'ma get looser than you do and then do my voodoo, then chill in the booth with your bitch. And that bitch gon' have the cheap on. I don't know what drug that she on. She gon' bring her friends and we gon' hand in hand, that's word to reach on. I got the perp and the Rizzler thick. He wanna get sentimental and shit. Let's get the show on the road where the grass is been most so you don't get no weeds on your lip. I'm gonna get my shady love.
Shady love. That's Scissor Sisters in collaboration with Azalea Banks. And they're right
not
here in
officially.
The studio. Really?
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty official now.
I know, people know.
Exactly. Is it featuring?
It wasn't
no featuring. What do you want to call it?
No, it wasn't if it was just Scissor Sisters. Actually, it was Crystal Pepsi featuring Crystal Pepsi.
Crystal Pepsi was my DJ project name.
Okay.
But there's no more Crystal Pepsi. Crystal Pepsi is now broken up.
Yeah, she.
That's illegal now in England. You can't say that.
Crystal Pepsi.
It sounds like a slang for something.
Well, that's why I had to. We couldn't trademark the name.
You know, Crystal Pepsi actually was a.
It was a real thing.
By Pepsi. It was.
What, like
it was
Tab Clear?
Yeah, it was a clear. Yeah. It was a clear Pepsi.
Oh, really?
Came out in like 1990.
Crystal Pepsi, yeah.
Man, I thought I was joking.
No, it was good. It was yummy. I loved it.
It's very legal to say, just not to name your DJ.
Or to drink.
It sounds like, yeah, it sounds like that's something from 1938, like Tab Clear. Okay. So the record is out. The record's out on Monday. And you said it's out in Australia and in Ireland already.
Yeah.
Tune in, folks, for that. Yeah, that's weird. Is that because you promoted it there and they feel that they have to get it out? Or
they
is
just have
just
weird release dates.
An accident of marketing? That's a strange thing.
They just have different countries have different, like, different days that they put records out.
And strangely enough, America's Tuesday, so it comes out last in America on the 29th.
What people, like, it's so... It's really bizarre because, like, the whole world should just get on one.
That's what I said.
Little
I was
clock
just
because there's
to,
nothing exclusive.
I was talking to the marketing lady from our label, who's amazing, and just saying, isn't the next step just a global record label? Because it's just like, you know, oh, we do this thing for the UK. Oh, but it's not happening anywhere else. Oh, but the release date's different.
Are
they do
still
their own
so contents, but like region specific. Though.
Yeah, and then
like,
the internet is everywhere, and people just don't. And then they try to block it in certain regions because it just doesn't.
It's really backwards.
Sense.
That's the weird bit of doing this job, having to presumably deal with a record company. I'm sure you love yours, but they are strange folk, or they are so strange organizations. They do feel a bit, you know.
Do you know when you sign?
They might not have dragged themselves into the 21st century and into 2012.
They're trying, and I was
just as much as you guys have.
This
is
a dumb fact, but you know, when you sign record deals now, you sign for the universe, not just for
what?
Really?
The world? Yeah.
What?
Did you sign for the universe?
Yeah, because they're anticipating.
That's really
anything,
desperate.
Yeah.
I live on Neptune, and you haven't ever toured here, and it's really pissing me off.
Well, just think when people start traveling to the moon, they would say, "Oh, well, you know, you can sell your album independently."
I like the intergalactic ambition of the Scissor Sisters. That's okay. And when you're listening, when you record, we talked about influences before of Magic Hour, the new record. Can you listen to stuff when you're writing new stuff? Would you have to kind of put yourself in a hermetically closed box so that you can concentrate on your own stuff?
I listen to a ton of stuff.
Yeah.
I used to kind of be like that, but last few years I listened to a ton of stuff.
We're not that band. I mean, we started out just trying to rip off things that we loved, and right. We did like a really kind of bad job of it at times, but like that's what was great, you know, that's what kind of works. I think
there's millions of people going to email in and disagree with you. You set that up.
What, that we do a bad job of ripping things?
No. I think people that you did a good job. It's all sound. It's good.
Do a good job at something. But yeah, I mean, I think that
a
lot
of
times when you're trying to get
things off, but I think we make
sound and then you get it kind of half wrong, and you know, that's sort of
that's kind of the fun of it to us. Is, you know, we are influenced by a certain song and we just hear it in that song we made and no one else ever sort of notices. The Elton John thing was really funny, you know, from the first
record.
Well,
that's a lot of people said that.
Oh, you guys are so influenced by Elton John. And Jake,
I had never listened to him in my whole life. Yeah. But when people started telling me that, I started, then I was like, oh, well, maybe I should check it out.
And it was just funny. Like, it was kind of, there was moments of homage to, like, Steely Dan, which I don't think anyone has ever said in a review before.
And that's the kind of stuff we're listening to. It was really fun. The first time I've ever played the music for my mom, that was the first thing she said. She said, you sound like Elton John. And it was a very strange thing. Because I had
you'd absorbed it by osmosis. As a
I
child,
think
it
does kind of
what
happens. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. And what happens? Do you read the notices when people go, oh well, they've just done this. It's Steely Dan meets Elton John, and
sometimes
do you read that? Do you care?
We
or do you go, yeah, okay,
stuff.
I quite like that.
We discover music that way.
Yeah,
sometimes.
You discover your influences when you've written about.
Yeah.
Okay,
well,
like
not
that.
Our influences.
That's the right way around, I think.
I think it's great. Yeah,
and I do. I'm always interested in what people have to say. Some critiques I think are really rotten, and some I think are really funny, and some I think are even something that's critical, I think I can I don't mind a good critique if it's like got something behind it.
And that's how you happily live in a delusion. You just pick out the things that you want to believe and then discount all the things you don't like.
Oh, I love pop. That's where we've got a nice email here from someone on the planet Pluto. They wonder if you're touring there. Where are you touring? Where are you taking the record this summer?
We are going through America. And we're going to go through...
That's a big tick. America, done.
America okay. is the summer for us, actually.
Is it? Is that, really is that where you always start your tours there?
No, just that's what it's going to be this summer. It's going to be fun.
America, then we're coming back here for the Olympics and stuff like that. And then hopefully we'll have...
We do some Southeast Asia. We do a big UK thing. Japan, yeah, I mean, it's...
Southeast Asia, do they let it go? Do they let it go when they come to Twisted Sisters gig? They're quite a polite audience.
Singapore was insane last summer there. It was really fun.
Yeah. Oh, they were great. Yeah, they were amazing.
And do you always kind of get the biggest welcome back home in New York City? Is that always where it kicks off? Or do you kind of like to shimmy into new territories and...
New York is kind of... always an awesome place for us to play. New York and... London, Glasgow is one of our favorite cities to play in.
Yeah.
For some reason, Glasgow is always like a homecoming.
Really?
I don't know why, but it always feels like it.
Well, it's that venue too. It's when we go to
Barrowlands and Glasgow.
As good as it gets. But there's also an element of the unexpected. But we go to random places that sometimes we just have like an incredible gig. I mean, Salt Lake City. Who would have thought?
We ended up in like East Russia. A couple months ago, and the whole band got out there, and we ended up this creepy hotel that looked like it was out of The Shining, and it was snowy, and like it was just really off, and the vibe was bad, and I started getting a fever, and I ended up getting so unbelievably sick. We'd flown everybody, the whole crew, all the band out there. It's like a 25-hour plane journey, and like I couldn't get out of bed, and we had to.
It all comes back to comfortably numb in the end.
sitting there getting injections and
they were sticking like McDonald's straws in my ass, and like
wow,
it was painful.
And getting them injections.
Okay, we'll have another track from the record.
He's having that much fun.
We can spin this. We can spin the Wheel of Fortune wherever we want to go. Which track?
Well, we can play anything. Should we just? What genre? What do you want? We have it all. We can give you anything.
Well, let's have something. Yeah, let's have. I mean, the big string quartet one that was leaked on the internet. Said that. Joking.
There is a string quartet one. And we'll play that one. It's a really.
You have a slower
melancholy
one?
Little song. Yeah, it's called Secret Life of Letters.
Secret Life of Letters.
What is the full speed of language when there is nothing to say? What's in the air? There must be something there, but it's not in service today. Sometimes the neighbors complain, the phone speaks another.
And that from the Scissor Sisters is Secret Life of Letters from the new record, Magic Hour. The Scissor Sisters in reflective mood.
It's somber.
Yeah, I wish we had a little bit of echo on our voices now.
You can probably add it later.
In reflective mood. We talked just while that song was playing about doing stripped down stuff, and I wondered whether you always wanted to sort of do the full stage show and stuff. We're going to try and crowbar you into coming in, obviously, and doing a session.
We
love doing it. It's kind of a test of some of these songs, too. It's really... fun to see you know, what we can get away with doing with a guitar and a piano.
Like a croak show.
Yeah.
What did you say, Dalmarkey?
Croak show.
Croak show. That's the up close to the mic.
Some of them are really nice.
Mm-hmm. I made a joke about a string quartet. And you're like, no, that's on the record.
It's there.
Chill out. We've thought of that.
Strings are Joan Vossar in that song. She co-wrote that kind of whole like, instrumental section. She's Jonas Policewoman, as she's otherwise known as.
Mm. I love her, yeah.
Yeah, she's
she
great.
Used
she
just, to live with Dell, and that's how we're
roommates and lovers.
She is a lover.
She is a lover.
She's not a fighter.
We do love that.
She is a fighter, actually.
She's a lover.
She's already tough.
She will wreck you.
Oh, God.
Seriously.
I had this image, but hey, you've been there.
Close she's to. About as cool as it gets.
She's
exceptionally super cool. Yeah. And is this when you've worked with a few different people on this record? How's that work? Is it a chance meeting in a club, or is it lunch? Is it sort of a more of a record company deal, or is it how does it work?
It's mostly people that we've had some sort of personal encounter or have kind of worked with or friends with or talked to or tried something out with, you know. You just try things out with people, and if they, sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. If they work, then you do more.
I think you should make an album with Steely Dan. I'm really feeling that.
I wonder if they're...
I don't know whether
still
they are.
Upright.
Oh, right.
That's all right. That was
no. They just, you know what? They just came to New York and did like every album. You know,
oh,
like,
at the Beacon, didn't they?
No, really. But it's just what's
well,
his
it's
face?
The two guys.
It's two of them. Yeah,
Donald Fagen and Walter.
Which it kind of always was. Yeah. Yeah.
And they're okay.
God,
and they're fun. They're fine.
Are they right? They're okay.
Asia cracks me up. That record. I think it's one of the funniest albums of all time.
It's got Peg on it.
What's that?
Deacon Blues and Peg and things on there.
Peg, yeah, Peg.
Yeah, Peg's great.
It's like the fan, like,
it's
Asia,
like the most
to
ridiculously trebly album of all time.
Yeah, it's also like the most, it's like the most fancy pants elevator music ever made. And for that, I absolutely
there's your
love
review,
it.
Steely Dan. Straight away there from Jake Shears. You picked another song to play us out on, Shining Star. Maybe give us a line on why we're going to listen to this.
Well, we've done some stuff with Two Bears recently, and they're super, super sweet. And the new Hot Chip's coming out, which is really exciting. Yeah. And then Joe, who's from Hot Chip and Two Bears, just did this mix, which I'm so in love with. I think it's going to be a massive song this summer. It's really special. And I've been DJing it, and you just see the room, like... The whole room lights up. It's an unbelievable tune.
I like that. I want to see people's eyes suddenly and then explode.
Yeah, it's this remix that he did. It's wicked.
So there's two versions of it. There's a radio version and a 9-minute.
Yeah,
version.
The 9-minute version is really where it's at. But you know, for
on,
time
we'll
constraints,
we'll see what we can do. I know. We'll maybe try and get that on the playlist.
Well,
play
we'll
that,
give you
so.
Something. Oh, it's, give people something to look up.
It's a yeah. it's a corker. It's really good.
I always like saying Google it.
Google it.
Google it.
Have you heard that song? Google me.
No.
Anthony did it,
yeah,
didn't he?
Anthony from Anthony the Jones.
Oh, really?
I don't know if it's actually out there.
Oh, but it's really funny.
It's Google me.
Google me.
Yeah. Who did the song, You Look Like a Gay?
You Look Like you a look Gay. Like Johnny gay. McGovern?
Was it? Did you ever hear that song, You Look Like a Gay?
It wasn't Johnny Cash, was it?
No, it wasn't Johnny Cash.
No, I don't know that
it's
song.
It's a good tune as well. You might want to Google
while
it.
While we're on good tunes.
While we're on Google.
Check out You Look Like a Gay.
Once you've got your laptop open, get on this. Get on You Look Gay. Jake, Baby Dally. Baby Dally. And,
Baby Dolly.
Baby Dolly.
We went to Japan once, and the record company lady called him Baby Doll.
The whole time. Did you ask her to stop?
Apparently it's hilarious to this day.
Sorry, that was just the most Freudian of all possible slips. Baby Daddy and Del Mar Key. Three quarters. Now we're back on Fractions of the Scissor Sisters. Thank you so much for joining us on the Monocle Weekly. And this is Shining Star. And that was Shining Light, as chosen by Nika, as chosen by the Scissor Sisters. I like that, but I kind of want to hear the 9-minute version. There's a 9-minute version of that song as well.
Oh, really?
Do you think you can sustain the dancing? I don't know. I think I might pass out about the 6-minute mark. I'm getting a bit hot just thinking about it.
Very fun. They were good guests.
They're really nice. I like it when people like that don't let you down, and they're exceptionally sweet.
Incredible.
Exceptionally sweet. You can put that on the poster.
They can stay around after work for a drink. It'd be fun to go out with them. I've been clubbing with Jake before.
Have you?
Yeah.
He looks like he's a fun man to go dancing with.
Yeah, twice actually.
Have
weirdly,
you?
In the same club. He's always at Horse Meat Disco, who we've had into Monocle a few times.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's a big fan of Horse Meat in Vauxhall, so met him there once.
I think I want people to put check out our website. I think there might be an amusing picture of them popping up on there.
Yes,
well.
I think so. Something. Spoiler alert.
Cool. After this, we're going to be speaking to Guy Delisle about Jerusalem. There's a switch for you. During his years working as an animator, our next guest, Guy Delisle, travelled all over the world to work with various studios. During these trips, he started recording his reactions to the culture and to the work. Delisle then turned those notes and sketches into a book, Shenzhen, and followed that up with Pyongyang, a book about a similar assignment in North Korea. He's now turned full-time cartoonist, but continued to travel the world with his wife and has just released Jerusalem, an exquisitely drawn travelogue about his time spent in Israel recently. Guy, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you.
Now, this is called, this is a graphic travelogue, a graphic novel and a travelogue. It's a beautiful piece of work.
Thanks a lot.
Is it sort of easier to tell perhaps some of the difficult stories from some of the difficult places you've been to? Is it easier to tell them in picture form?
For me, that's the only way, because I would never be able to do literature. I really use simple sentence, and my drawings wouldn't go in a gallery, but the mix of both do comics, and I'm really comfortable with that narration process, and I feel very comfortable whenever I use comics to tell a story, because they are, for me, very powerful. And whenever I use I worked on these type of books, I'm also surprised to see all the tools I have, like a dialogue, a direct dialogue, and just a plain drawings with no text. For me, it's a good way of telling a story.
And I mean, the graphic novel, it's had a kind of, it's getting its incredible time in the limelight at the moment, isn't it? You've got the likes of Art Spiegelman having his big retrospective at in Paris recently, and you've got books like Persepolis and the rest being translated into film as well. Do you see yourself very much working within this this kind of tradition of graphic novels that have a real kind of political heart to them and have something to say as well?
Well, yeah, you were mentioning Art Spiegelman, and for the people of my generation, reading Mouse was an answer to a question that everybody is saying to himself, reading comic books, that I think we can do much more than what we are reading, kind of teenager comics. And then you arrive with Mouse, and that was the answer. Everybody said, yeah, it can be as powerful as that, because Mouse was such a masterpiece. Mm. And it took a long time before it got into shape, and then a bunch of authors got together, did some publishing house called L'Association in France, and it became more and more popular. And something that started as a small niche 15 years ago became very big now, and there's lots of people like appreciate these books. It's probably just like me. I stopped reading comic books after a while when I was a young adult, and I went back because I saw people were doing comics for my age, and I thought, oh, that's interesting. So people, I think, come back to reading comic books.
And is it easier to just straight prose writing is often quite loaded with the way that the adjectives you use, the way you describe things and scenes. When something is as sort of multifarious and tricky as Jerusalem, the city of Jerusalem, is it easy that you're only doing dialogue between characters? It's speech bubbles and a bit of narration in the corner.
Well, maybe it's easier. It's just, it's more efficient for me because instead of having a description, I'm just going to use a drawing. I don't need text, so it's faster. And in a comic, you don't have much place. If you can use three sentences instead of four, I prefer to use three. Everything has to be concise and efficient, and that's what I like because that's kind of the way I work in everyday life, trying to resume everything I can see. And it's a very good way to entertain and to explain things, and I like that mix.
I mean, the old adage is, you know, a picture's worth a thousand words, and you kind of have this condensed experience of it. But do you find that as someone who also, you know, has a career in journalism before they had this career as a graphic novelist, does it kind of feed back into the discipline of journalism? Do you find yourself approaching how you write in different ways? Certainly, I don't know you, Rob, but I've felt with radio, it's completely changed the way that I approach an interview for you know, for a print piece. It's kind of, it feeds back into your other work as well.
Yeah. I don't see myself as a journalist, even though I had to explain things in Jerusalem, because it would be strange not to explain the conflict, or in North Korea. I read the books I could read about North Korea before going there, because I knew they would give me only the propaganda answer, so I wanted to know what was going on behind. And well, I have to explain that, but I'm always afraid to be boring, so I kind of condense everything so the people read the books, turn the page, and they learn, but they have fun at the same time. And I don't see myself as a journalist, because I go in Jerusalem with my wife. I spend 1 year there, and if actually nothing happens fun and interesting to me, I'm going to read back my notes, and then I decide if I do a book or not. And I've been in place where I was reading back my notes, and I thought, well, no, I don't think I have enough stuff. Well, after 1 year in Jerusalem, I said, yeah, I think I can talk about that place.
Yeah, it sounds like a fertile ground for a graphic or any other sort of novel. Do you lift ideas from everyday experiences then? I mean, how much of it is true to your experience of spending a year in the city?
Well, if I would go there as a tourist or as a pilgrim, I wouldn't have much to say because everybody has said that. Mm. And after a year being there, meeting people, and I got a hint when I was with my friend who's he's a Lutheran priest, and he gave me a little place in his church to work because he's a very comic book enthusiast. And he says, "Oh, we have a room we don't need." So I was telling him that with children at home, it was very hard to work. So one day I was in that church on the Mount of Olives, and there was a storm outside.
It's a good office.
Yeah, and I was watching some of the movie he gave me, which are horror films, because he's a very horror film enthusiast.
I love this Lutheran priest. He's into comics and horror movies.
Well, he changed my way of seeing priests. Yeah, I was not used to that. And I was watching this horror movie, and I had to go to the church, but it was closed because I was too late, and I had to go all the way up and down to on that tower, and it was all pitch black because I didn't know where the light was. And I said, well, if I ever do a book, this is going to be a funny part of it.
And it's cool. I mean, and the geography, I mean, the geography in the book changes from place to place, and it's all sort of beautifully done there. Is it quite nice also for people that haven't been to that city to simply illustrate it as you have done as well, and to show what it looks like and put people in a physical context?
Yeah, I'm more precise because I knew a lot of people would have been in Jerusalem or would be interested in reading the books, and I wanted them to recognize the place that I've been, the place that they've been to, because there's in this old city and there's not so many streets, and I wanted to be precise, and it's easy to find image because everybody has taken so many pictures of Jerusalem. That was easy. And and when I do a book like that, when I arrive, I was thinking, when I came back from Jerusalem, I said, I don't think I can do a book because it's too complicated. And the good thing about comics, you can do, well, I do graphics and I put arrows and I can explain things. And I had the people when I was coming back saying, oh, well, you had to go from east to west and cross East Jerusalem and West Jerusalem, and so you had to cross the wall every day. And I said, no, the wall is not there. The wall is behind. It's between Palestine and Israel. Yeah. And I said, well, I knew that if I do a comic book, I'm just going to need two or three, half a page, and this is going to be very clear because you do a drawing and say, this is here and here, and that's it. You get it. You don't have to have a big article to explain that. So that's what I like about comic. It's very efficient when you want to explain things.
Mm. I've got a copy of the book in front of me, and it's largely in kind of black and white and sepia with occasional colour highlights, but just the imagery is extraordinarily kind of vibrant and expressive. Is there one kind of narrative arc that you're following in this book, or are you really just kind of bringing the city to life, showing aspects of the city? I mean, how does the book kind of develop?
Since it's a chronicle, the story is going to start with me arriving at the airport and leaving from the airport, and everything between that kind of grows up as you feel the everyday pressure, being in Jerusalem, because it's a conflict place and you have soldiers, and it's very magic at the same time when you're in the old city, but when it's packed with soldiers, the magic kind of fades away. So you have that, and you have everyday life. It's all mixed together. I really have the feeling when I do that I'm writing a big, long postcard to my family to explain what I've been experienced for a year in Jerusalem. It's not such an easy place to explain because there's so many levels, but I just concentrate on the few ones. And of course, if I talk about the Muslims and I draw, I'm going to have to talk about the Jews, and then I'm going to have to talk about the Christians. I've met the Samaritan, and then I've met the Bedouin. So there's a lot of people there. And I was glad to talk about the major one we hear about, but then to go see the small ones, the Bedouin in the desert, that was quite fascinating to see.
Mm. Israel, a fascinating place to spend time and to open up, but also one that's very saturated. I mean, everyone has an opinion on Israel, and it's one that's probably quite heavily filtered by the international press. What was your experience of living in Israel, getting to know Israelis, and over the course of a year, how did your kind of experience the country change?
Well, it didn't change much because I didn't have more idea about the situation, because I have to admit that I didn't know almost nothing to the situation. Well, the basic things, but I didn't know the details, and I arrived there and I was kind of, I start from a blank page, and then I I started from there. I think which was an advantage to tell the story, because I could start from scratch. And on the first day, I had to buy diapers for my daughter. And then we were in the Arabic area, and it was closed. The store was closed because we were in the east part of Jerusalem. And I just saw a big mall, shopping mall. I said, well, we can go there. Then the MSF people said, well, it's a settlement. We're not supposed to encourage and buy stuff in the settlement. But I really needed these diapers. I said, yeah, but what am I going to do? So I thought it's interesting, because then I like to mix everyday life and the rest of the conflict and the history, because it's all there. And I really, I like to describe how the people live there under that big conflict situation and religious conflicting situation as well. Yeah, and I try to do it as funny as I can. Since it's a comic book, it's easy.
A comic book in more ways than one.
Yeah, so
surprisingly so.
Yeah, I make people laugh with Jerusalem. It's not something you get to see so much these days.
It's not always the greatest, the punchline for many jokes. Guy de Lisle, thank you so much for coming into the Monocle Weekly to tell us about Jerusalem. We're going to try to make the transition smoothly, and that is this. We're going to do Guns and Vegas next.
Now, Las Vegas offers a wealth of diversions for the discriminating punter. But what happens if you're sapped by scrutinising Cirque du Soleil and bored beyond belief by Baccarat? Well, the latest great idea to help you let off steam on the strip is to head to an upmarket lounge for some R&R. Nothing radical about that, you might think, but this is a lounge with a difference. Forget the cocktails and think Kalashnikovs. Monocle's new boy, Tom Edwards, spoke to the mastermind behind the operation, the marvellously monikered Genghis Cohen, and started by asking him what inspired him to start up Machine Guns Vegas.
Machine Guns Vegas is a concept we came up with sort of out of, you know, like a lot of concepts that came out of need. We have a business where we were doing training in Las Vegas, specifically training for self-defense, but with firearms. You know, a lot of times in the United States, in a lot of states, it's relatively easy to get a gun, but to find decent training for using that firearm, especially in your home, is difficult. So we thought the best thing to do was to start a business where we were actually training people specifically how to use firearms in their home in the event of a home invasion, you know, because a lot of people have families and, you know, learning how to clear a room correctly, learning how to clear a hallway correctly, teaching them sort of home defense tactics. So we started out with that kind of business, and what we discovered we needed was an indoor gun range. And we'd been using local gun ranges, but we had a lot of high-profile clients, and those clients needed to be discreet about where they went. And we had a couple of experiences that were bad experiences at local ranges, so we thought, you know, we're going to have to build our own. Plus, we're sort of looking at these ranges going, you know, we can do a better job than this, because my original background was military. I was an army officer in New Zealand, but after that, I was in the nightlife business, so nightclubs, restaurants, bars, that type of thing. You know, Vegas has become this place now where it's all about service and people expect a very high standard of service. And all the gun ranges in town were busy, but they just didn't look very good at all. They kind of looked like beat up old garages. So we thought, why don't we make something that's a little more cool, a little hip, and has a good feel to it and a comfortable feel to it, so that when tourists come, it's a really all-encompassing experience, not just shooting the firearm, but actually, you know, deciding what you're going to shoot and buying your targets and all that kind of thing. I used sort of my nightclub background and built a gun range that looks and feels like an ultra lounge. So when you walk in, you kind of think, is this a club? Is it a bar? Is it a boutique? You know, what is it? There's gun paraphernalia around, but it's much more discreet than, say, a regular gun store would be. So that's kind of how the business started. And then we said, well, you know, if we're going to have people coming in to see guns, we should have our staff looking sort of good too, but let's not have sort of, we call them in the States the gun store commando. It's like the, you know, the guy who couldn't quite make it into the police or couldn't quite make it in the military, but has five guns on him, and we didn't want that look and feel. So we actually hired a bunch of attractive ladies, and we have them dressed like sort of a Lara Croft look, and they carry guns, and, you know, but everything and actually inside the range is, we tried to incorporate technology as much as possible. So everything's done with iPad, iTouch. It's very similar to a Mac store in the way that we process a client. We use a Mac-based POS system, which is very interactive for the customer. So we've tried to make some neat sort of changes to it where we can.
Now, I'm sure you've been asked this question before, but I think a lot of people, their first reaction would be, you know, the kind of relaxed lounge feel, firearms in Vegas, this is a recipe for disaster. How do you sort of guarantee and ensure that the experience is safe for your clients, people who work there, for everyone sort of around the place?
Well, America is probably the most litigious society in the world. So obviously, when we started this business, we were very aware of that. I'm a veteran myself. My business partner is a veteran as well from the US military. So what we did is we hired 70% of all our employees are retired Army, Air Force, Navy, or Coast Guard, or Marines. Our range staff, specifically our range staff, who actually work with the firearms, they are all ex-military. So in order for someone to be a shooting instructor in our range, you have to be ex-military. And then we have senior range masters and range safety officers. And so the range safety officers are a more junior position, ex-military as well, though. And we basically train people up to do it. Just, you know, when I was in the military, I taught a lot of people to shoot. And, I was often on a range, or I was a range safety officer at a shoot. But it's a very different environment because you've got someone who may have never even touched a gun before in their life, and they're firing a fully automatic weapon indoors, you know, with other people around. So the safety procedures have to be, you know, extremely... We're very, very cautious whenever we do anything. So a number of ranges you go into the United States, you could walk in as a British citizen, you could put your ID down, say, I'd like to shoot that gun, and that gun, and they'll pull the guns off the wall, give them to you with some ammunition, and send you into the range and let you shoot. But the problem with that is that, you know, you could shoot yourself, you could shoot your foot, you could shoot the guy, because you've never handled a firearm before.
My foot would definitely be at risk.
Yeah, exactly. So what we do is our range masters actually stand right next to you. They actually have one hand on your shoulder, and they're constantly making sure that you have the gun down range, that there's no safety violations at all. And then if there's any issues or someone gets a little nervous or scared, the range master's right there to take care of them. So
amazing.
Very safe.
It does sound very safe. You mentioned already your background in the military. I just wonder, is this a sort of an unusual step that you've made, or amongst your contemporaries, the number of the sort of ex-military men go down this avenue? It seems a kind of an unusual career path to wind up in Vegas, perhaps.
Yeah, I'm the only one of my peers who has a machine gun range in Vegas. Yeah, I will say I do have peers that are, you know, running security operations off in the Gulf of Aden, and I've got other friends that are, you know, doing demining programs all over the world. So they're sort of in the military realm, but mine's a little bit different. It definitely is, yeah.
And those things never appealed to you, because I know a lot of military guys go into, say, security and private security, that kind of thing. Didn't appeal. I can see, maybe was it the bright lights of Vegas always was in the back of your mind?
You know, to be honest, I did a little bit of work in Africa. And it's definitely much more fun living in Vegas than in the jungles of Africa, without a doubt. So, you know, when I was in the military, I was never in the special forces or anything like that. I was in the logistics side of things. So, you know, I was a bullets and blankets kind of guy, is what I used to say. But once again, there's actually a great need for that too in a civilian world, especially in operations all around the world, United Nations operations, those types of things. But you know, Vegas is just a great place to live, and for what we do, you know, once again, one of the things that makes us so unique is the incorporation of women into what we do, because it's an incredibly male-dominated arena. So we're one of the, I think we're the only range in Vegas that has female veterans teaching people how to shoot machine guns. And that's been very successful for us as well. And Vegas was kind of the only place that you could kind of make it work the way that we've done it.
I wanted to ask you as well, it's interesting about that side of things with women being more strongly involved. What kind of reaction do you get as you travel around and tell people about this? I mean, it's interesting, obviously, here in the UK. I know you're heading to Africa, I think you were saying to me before, later this week. What's the sort of response that people have, and does it change very, very distinctly as you travel around?
You know, it's funny. I know we're on radio, so I can't show you the pictures, but the girls that we have working for us... they're very attractive girls. They're actually all models. They model as well, but they were in the military. So it was funny. I was at a dinner recently with a good friend, and I was saying, oh, you know, you should come to the range and shoot. And he goes, you know, I've shot blah, 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 blah. And I said, let me show you what my range masters look like. And I showed him on my iPhone. I said, these are the girls that will actually take you through the shooting. He goes, I'll be there tomorrow. So the reaction I get is great. Funnily enough, one of the best reactions I get is actually from females. you know, I've taken now a lot of ladies into the range and they've never shot a firearm before. And there's definitely a much greater comfort level for them when they're being instructed by a woman. And our girls are great. They're just fantastic. They're very well trained, but they've got a very good way of, you know, transferring the information that we need to get across to the customer to make sure that they have a good experience and a safe experience.
Just finally, gang, so I just wanted to ask you, what's next? I know you're heading off to Africa, I believe, soon. What's next on your schedule?
Yeah, I have a couple of days in Paris, and then I'm off to Gabon. I spend a lot of time in I have a home in Ghana, and I have a small gold mining operation in Ghana. And we're starting to do some other consulting work in Africa, security type consulting work. There's a lot of asset protection, personal protection opportunities coming up in that arena. And we do that as another aside to our business. All the guys that we work with, a very good friend of mine, ex-New Zealand SAS guy, lives in Memphis, Tennessee. And he has a whole training facility there. He's been running for about 20 years. So we partner up with him, and we do a lot of training for everything from law enforcement agencies, different military units. So we're hoping to expand that business in Africa.
Genghis Cohen, I think you can never get tired of amusing riffs on Genghis.
I don't think his parents called him that.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't know.
He's probably called something like Isaac.
Isaac Cohen kind of goes more.
But Genghis is definitely a lot cooler.
But he started in Las Vegas and ended up ruling all of Asia.
One of the more unusual characters.
I'm going to Google him. I want to know what he looks like. I wonder if he's got the kind of like a sort of wispy Fu Manchu beard and a sort of wispy moustache.
Let's get the full lowdown from Tom.
Exactly. I quite enjoyed that that Monocle Weekly. That was
it was good. That was whistle by.
It was up and down. It was in and out. It was here and there. It was Jerusalem politics and saving lives and cartoons in Jerusalem.
And machine guns. What more do you want from broadcasting?
And the Scissor Sisters. I don't know how they got their name, but I'll have to Google that as well. I don't know what that means.
Don't Google it. Work.
Really?
Maybe.
Safe search is off. thank you very much for tuning in to episode 151 of the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bound, and Jonathan Openshaw. The show was produced by Paul Noble and researched by Tom Hall. Please join us same time, same place. For now, thank you very much for tuning in. I'm Robert Bound.
I'm Jonathan Openshaw.
Goodbye.
Bye.